Hello, this is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kewell.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And spring has sort of come and then sort of gone back again. We've had a few nice days, and now there's snow in the north of the country again.
I was out in the garden working this morning.
You have no heat sensors in your exterior layer. This is well known.
Well, yeah.
And this time we're going to talk about NPCs and PCs. I think that's reasonable to say. And we're going to talk a bit about the bundle of holding. But first, Roger wishes to say...
Well, thank you very much to people who have dropped some money in our tip jar. This encourages us to keep doing the show. Thank you to Dave Morris. We are not worthy. We are not worthy.
We are slightly unworthy.
Robert Wolfe and John, all of whom have done so this month. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we appreciate it. It'll keep a spring in our step this spring. As we keep saying, as I keep saying, the nice people at the Bundle of Holding include us in the free distribution of their upcoming wares, so that we can talk about it and influence you. We are influencers, us, of prime importance in the new world.
I should just say, for the record, I have never felt the slightest desire to smash my face with a brick. Other people may have felt that desire to smash my face with a brick, but I personally have not.
I can't help feeling those people have been in reading Pratchett about auto-retrophrenology and taking it the wrong way. Be this as it may. That'll require a footnote. Be this as it may, this time we have two things we'd like to talk about. We only talk about them if we think they're of interest either generally or to us. And this month we're going to talk about, first of all, Trail of Cthulhu. This is Pelgrane Press's gumshoe-derived version of the venerable topic about horror role-playing. And they are planning to bring out the second edition this year sometime. It will rise from the deep.
They're going to have a Kickstarter, so, you know.
Well, they've had the Kickstarter. I think they've had the Kickstarter. And they are getting it together for publication.
I should say, even though this is not a huge update, they fix a bunch of things which fairly, you know, I'm not saying this will make things worse. I think it's going to be an improvement. But yeah, all the stuff in this bundle will work perfectly well with the second edition. However, yeah, on previous form, they and every game publisher knows, if the core book says second edition and the adventure says first edition, people ain't going to buy the adventure anymore. Thus, I think this bundle.
Well, I say unto you, young Padawans, that you should learn from the masters and know that you can often perfectly well rebore and rejig and resurface previous editions. And indeed, many people find this to be fun.
Especially in this case, where it's, as I say, it's not a huge difference. But anyway.
No. This, whatever they do with the next edition, is going to follow the structure of a gumshoe adventure, and those are built into the way these things are structured or outlined. And you can grab hold of just about all of this. This is mostly a reprint of earlier offers, but there are three new volumes in this, which is Fearful Symmetries and the accompanying Book of New Jerusalem, which is about English mysticism between the two wars and how it ties in with the horrors of the Cthulhu mythos. I think this is on a sliding scale, depending on how you want to run the scenario. But I do wish I had understood William Blake, on which most of this is centred. But I failed my mysticism test at university, and I couldn't get my head around the prophetic books of William Blake very much at all.
Well, looking on the bright side, if you had fully understood the works of William Blake, you would probably be, you know, up a tree talking to the squirrels or something by now. So
I might be Alan Moore if I had understood William Blake. And he's got money.
The thing to remember, I always feel, when considering the works of William Blake, is when he says he saw an angel, he is not speaking metaphorically.
Yeah. What he looks like to the outside people, well, we're stuck on the outside of William Blake.
So this is, in any case, Steve Dempsey's long-running campaign converted to use as a campaign supplement. I have heard many good things about this from the players and, indeed, from Steve himself talking about it at the YSTC Games Days. I do have a slight reservation in that I remember my own Occult World War II game, which was a great game from the point of view of the players, but a lot of it was constructed in response to things the players did. In other words, the players would express an interest in something and I would fill out that part of the setting.
It is the thing you have to do if you are creating...
So if I just published that setting for a different GM and a different group of players, it would not have the same spark of responsiveness and fun in it that my original campaign did. I am worried slightly that to a group that didn't indulge quite as much in the Blakeian mysticism that tried to run it from the book as opposed to in a responsive way, it would not be as much fun. But then again, this is a challenge for the GM. So,
I would say take this, and if it sparks something in you, then you use it to light your own flame from it.
Also, separately, the Book of the New Jerusalem is basically a collection of folkloric weirdness in England, which you can use in practically anything.
Yeah. The other new thing is Cthulhu Apocalypse, which goes in the place that the later books of the Laundry have gone, into the world after the unspeakable has spoken and the undefinable has defined itself and the world is in the wreckage and you are the last human beings alive crawling around the ankles of the great Cyclopean ones. I'm not at all sure that that's fun. I think part of the fun of adventuring the Cthulhu mythos is the sense that you have held off the end for a little while, even if it is futile to do so.
Yeah, this is something that some of the earlier adventures did as well, and I think it reaches its flower in the Cthulhu Apocalypse adventures, that... To at least some of the reason I played this sort of game is the feeling that maybe I could make a difference, maybe I will fail to make a difference, but I could.
Oh, yeah.
And these are explicit. I mean, there are no spoilers here. The introduction says that these are adventures in which the world ends, and even if you are one of the survivors, you are basically doomed in the fairly short term thereafter.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a big fan of On the Beach, brackets the book, not the film.
Uh-huh.
The film fundamentally misses the point, but that's a different podcast. But A, I don't want to do that all the time, and B, I think it is hard to do well in the context of role-playing, because it is very much about not so much what can you do, as role-playing games tend to be, but who you are. Die well or badly? And the point is, and I'm looking again at On the Beach here, that this doesn't matter to anybody except you.
This might make one of Robin Laws's one-to-one. What has he called it? Based out of Hill Folk, the story system one-to-one. That it might make a good tale to be told with one protagonist and one GM and talking about feelings and motivations and style.
Possibly.
But it's not a party. It's not a party campaign. We should not just talk about the new stuff. There is all the old stuff, for as far as I can tell, all the officially published old stuff.
I don't know if it's everything, but certainly it's an awful lot. I would like just to say a bit about Gumshoe in general.
Go on.
The big fuss when it was launched, which was 2007, I think, and I was still listening to Ken and Robin talk about stuff back then.
Why still do?
And they boosted it quite a lot, understandably. But the big thing they made a fuss about was you basically never are stymied because you missed the clue.
Yeah.
I feel that to some extent this was a problem that didn't really exist anymore, at least among the people I played with, who may well not be representative of investigative gamers, because GMs had worked out that, well, yeah, if you say, well, you didn't make the spot hidden, you didn't find the diary that will lead you to the next location, yeah, okay, we'll just stop here, I guess. This is not fun. It's not fun for the players or the GM. So, you know, you don't do that. But anyway, that was the thing I made of. I mean, Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering, which we've talked about before, is five years before this, and that has the whole thing about each scene should contain clues that could lead you to any of several other scenes that will get you further along in the adventure. And then, yeah, if you only find one of the four, then that's fine.
Yeah, I think that of the things that that Gumshoe does, the structuring of the nodes of the adventure, of the clues leading to clues, and the optional trails that you can take towards the same conclusion, that is the strongest thing it does.
Yeah,
I think you could have solved the problem that Robin saw by a slight modification of the usage of standard role playing games, saying that if you always get the core clue, and if you succeed at various levels of success, then you get more. That would have mostly have solved the problem that he was seeing, and we wouldn't have the points based resolution of non-investigative.
Well,
things,
I'll come back to that in just a moment. But
all right.
As I see it, this is something. What you can do is something like, you know, the action scene in a James Bond film is exciting, not because you think, is he going to die, because you know he's not, but you think, how is he going to get away from this? Who else is going to get hurt in the process? That kind of thing. That's what the stakes are. But anyway, the thing that they've never talked about as part of the blurb, though it's very much present in my experience of playing the system, is the enforced spotlight sharing. So, yeah, you've got the core clue. If you spend a point off your relevant investigative skill, you can learn something extra. And the primary effect of this, and yes, it gives you another avenue of investigation, which you don't need, but is nice to have. But also, your character gets to do a little awesome thing. You know, ooh, I am an expert entomologist, and I can tell that these larvae were from this, this, or this, and therefore we should look at that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you think of it in terms of I don't know, one of the CSI shows, which tend to be one of my touchstones for this sort of thing, because I think because they did it in a very basic way, and it's very easy to see what they're doing. From an analytical point of view, it also means, because my character only has so many points of whatever to spend, this is spotlight sharing, because what I've done my awesome thing, so you get to do your awesome things with your points that you haven't spent yet.
Yeah.
And which is fine if you're going to do that. But yeah, as you say, they use essentially the same mechanic for the non-investigative abilities. So I have just done some stunt driving or punched someone or climbed a wall. And now I am no better at that thing, though I am still perfectly capable in the other things, than somebody who's completely untrained until I've had a rest.
I think it doesn't quite work like that, but
that's the way it always seems to happen in games I've played.
Okay, well, in that case, I agree. That is the mechanic that isn't satisfactory about this. But let us not allow our kvetching about game mechanics to not recommend a very worthy collection of stuff.
Yeah, there is one very slight caveat I would have, which is particularly in the early adventures, and this is something that fans of the system say as well, it's not just grumpy old Roger. A lot of in the early days, they were quite inconsistent about what you actually needed to spend points on and what a spend would give you. Because the rules didn't do a great job of making that clear. Individual authors made their own choices. That is very much something that, as I understand it, they are going to make more consistent in the second edition. But if you're running these early adventures from this offer, you might want to be aware of that and think, is this actually worth
Yeah.
exactly
well,
what it is?
Well, hopefully the second edition will do something to correct that and to give a better GM advice, having, let us say, filed off some of the rough bits.
But in any case, that bundle is running until the 6th of April.
Running a little longer is Scion, the RPG. The offer is actually called Scion Origin. Scion started out as a White Wolf product, and it uses the same, sometimes annoying, put a dice pool and try and reach a target with each die. Each success is a success. Each success on a die it counts towards the successes you need, which may be only one.
I've played this specific iteration of the system in another product from Onyx Path, this company, which was They Came From Beneath the Sea, which is the a pulp 50s science fiction style game.
A friend said to me that this was basically, it seemed to him, Percy Jackson, the role-playing game. Now, checking, I find that Percy Jackson, the first Percy Jackson novel, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, came out 2 years before the first edition of Scion. So maybe it was inspired, and maybe it was just in the air that people were dreaming of becoming demigods.
I think we can establish that a Scion is a step below that. You know, you are the offspring of a god, but you only have fairly pathetic powers, and you will gradually increase that until eventually you can start calling yourself a demigod.
Yeah, there are three books here. Well, two books in the basic offer, and three core books overall. The Scion Origin, which is, yes, you have just discovered that it's significant that you have wings, or that you can breathe underwater, or whatever it may be.
And when Dad said he was going out for a pack of cigarettes, it was actually to fight the Furies.
Hero is slightly up from that. And then there is, in the expanded extra bit, there is Scion Demigod. Now, I believe the original system, I believe, had three levels, one above Demigod. But these are about surviving in the world in which divinities are going around bonking mortals, and sometimes they help their mortal, semi-mortal offspring, and sometimes they don't, and they always prefer their own semi-mortal offspring to other gods' semi-mortal offspring. And you are a group of people who are semi-mortal offsprings of varying gods.
So there's obviously,
and together you fight the Titans.
Yeah, everybody agrees. It's that classic thing. All the pantheistic mythologies are true, but none of the monotheistic ones, because that would be hard. Also, people might object.
I think the first edition, if my memory isn't failing me again, sort of implied that the monotheist religions were there, but only at the level of the other religions. And in this one, they've rejigged the background, so it's a parallel world in which monotheism was not as successful. It's still there, but it wasn't as successful in this world.
I have seen the anime series in which Jesus and Buddha are sharing a flat in Tokyo, so, you know.
Oh, dear. Oh, I'm sorry. The fish and loaves and the sushi jokes just write themselves, don't they?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we did talk about this idea some episodes back, and I don't think we actually talked about this system particularly, because I at least had never played it. I do find it interesting. I think the mechanics are rubbish, because essentially they did not ask a statistician to see previous rant about dice pool systems.
All right. And this is derived off White Wolf's
first edition White Wolf for that.
First edition White Wolf. And who knows? I have encountered dice systems which cause my players to revolt more, but none of them are statisticians. As far as I none of them are specialist in statisticians. They probably know a thing or two.
Well, I think I've said before, when Nick was running this for Watson Hall, we talked about the system and he was really not happy with it, and I ended up working out the probabilities and constructing a table. So it says, okay, if you've got... If you're rolling four dice with your standard stat plus skill, whatever, yeah, here is your chance of a botch, here is your chance of one success, here is your chance of two or more. So that the GM can at least say, okay, this is a reasonably hard thing for a competent person to do. Because there is really very little guidance, or rather there's some guidance, but you can't trust it when they say this is a hard task or whatever.
I have with my narrativist mind, tended to throw an extra difficulty on the dice pool or otherwise fiddle with the basic idea according to what the story seems to require.
Players
who know a bit about mathematics always complain about this.
They do have, I think they call them complications, which are basically does not exactly increase the number of successes, but... if you do not buy it off with a spare success, then it will be a complication ongoing in your dealing with whatever it is.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting way of looking at it. But, yeah.
Could be. But you know the trouble I had with complications in Genesis, and in fact with all of Genesis. This looks like an interesting reworking of an earlier idea. I don't know what its development stage is, where the way we did with Trail of Cthulhu. But I think it's still a living system.
It's all labelled as second edition.
Is 2 years old at this point. So I don't know if there are plans from Onyx Path to continue to supplement this. But it looks interesting and it's going cheap. And therefore, I recommend it.
And that is until the 13th of April.
Welcome, friends, to Uncle Michael's Corner of Candid and Cerebral Advice. We have a request from a frequent caller, Roger Bell West. Roger, tell us, what is your problem that we can solve today?
Well, here's a specific example of it in a game that you're playing in.
All right.
Consider the Bayern campaign, which has a lot of NPCs written up for it. Basically, the all the department heads and the senior ship crew across the mission. 20 or 30, something like that.
Yeah.
And they have backgrounds, not sadly in a form that I can give to the players. If only it weren't locked down with copyright, I would love to write a player briefing of, you know, here is what you know about the captain. But they didn't do it that way, and I can't do it because of copyright. But anyway, yeah, I know a lot about these people, but you haven't. To some extent, this is my failure, I think. But essentially, you haven't expressed any great interest in talking with them. You collectively, the players, and across the other campaign as well.
I think from my memories, that's because we put questions to the GM, and the GM doesn't refer us to a character. Except in a very few circumstances, he gives the general answer that our research will bring out. And that, I think, is failing on a level of soap opera. It's not making the life on board the ship real.
Mm.
And that's a failure. That's something that I would feel is contrary to at least a part of the what the entire adventure is about. It's about going out with these people into the void and discovering things along with them.
So perhaps when I say the situation is this, what this should be is perhaps taking the form of the flotilla's XO giving a briefing saying the situation is this.
Yes, or when we want to know what's the significance of this strange substance we have found, we have to go down into the lab and talk to Derek. Derek is very annoying.
but really sound on insect design.
Oh, dead sound on all forms of life that don't actually have any gender. Actually, that's wrong. Insects have gender, but yeah, I take your point. Now I am forced to do this myself in my current campaign because it's the structure of a university, and they are students, and they have to go out and petition the staff to give them extraordinary help or tell them where they really ought to go, and that sort of binds in the characters of the various grumpy or avuncular or just weird members of staff. So I feel that you've got to take what is there and you've got to use it. How good are these depictions of the NPCs on board the ship, of the rest of the crew? What do they speak about?
There are at least personality summaries for everyone, and mostly the what they've done in the past and why it has led them to be on this mission.
That sounds, especially with modern a mongoose traveller, that sounds ideal, and it's also ideal for tying into the player characters' backgrounds and the player characters' experiences. My character in this campaign is an ex-scout, and therefore he will react in a particular way to other ex-scouts on the mission, and probably other ex-members of other services, because he's encountered them on his travels and doesn't think much of them.
For that matter, your captain of Entdecker, who is not provided by the adventure because they assume that a PC might want to do that. They don't say anything about the Drove Entdecker, but yeah, we are British, so nobody wants to be the person in charge. the character I ran up for that, what specifically was in the Azanian Navy. This is the South African post-reform. It's all a bit weird. Don't ask too many questions. And transferred to the scouting branch of it, which is for that particular polity under the same overall administration, but definitely a separate section, because they wanted to put her behind a desk and she liked being a ship captain.
Yeah.
So there is a certain, probably a common feeling there of...
Bloody bureaucrats everywhere.
What you'd really want to be doing is outdoing something. Getting your leg bitten off by an Adrian Greebly, that kind of thing.
Why do you think I came on this insane expedition anyway, Captain? all right, so taking this as advice, let me start by saying, if you've got the material, use it. Don't elide over the personalities if you're going to have NPC personalities. And if somebody's gone to all the trouble of providing you with lots of NPC characters, don't elide over their preparations, but make use of them. We're talking here not about a one-off characters, you know, the thug, the night soil farmer, or whatever you meet on your travels. They might turn out to be important later, but at the start, at least, they are just an accent and an attitude.
A thing that I have made work successfully is you could sum it up as the escort quest, but for video gamers that has negative implications. So I think of it as the technical specialist, and you have to get them to the place where they can do their thing, but they are not fighty infiltrated types like the party. So you basically have to carry them across stuff, but it's not just they are completely useless and you get them to the plot point. It's they do a thing, which is player characters do a complicated and hard thing that takes a lot of training. So do these guys. It's just a different thing.
Yeah.
So there I think is the place to start with common ground, and then you know you're camping one night and you can get chatting or whatever.
Yeah, I think when you're constructing, when you're doing the preparation and depth that Mongoose did for this version of the campaign. I think when you're creating people, first of all, you use what the system will give you. If there is a life path system such as Mongoose provides, then that's just gravy. But you have to look at, I think, first of all, what the character's function is for the campaign, what the character's function is for any player characters they've got a relationship with, a mentor, contact, friend, or even antagonist. You've got to define those in a useful way that will work with them, and then you've got to take the GM's needs into consideration. I would say that what you want is hooks for the GM that he can hang a sustainable performance on. If this character isn't just going to pop in once and go away, you want something about them that can trigger memories and create more characterization.
Even if it's just an accent.
Even if it's just an accent. It can be, and if you don't do accents well, then make it an attitude. Make it the reaction that that he has to the player characters, or maybe just one of the player characters. What they want, what they can do, are they amused by them? Are they irritated with them? Are they willing to sacrifice everything for them? I very rarely give characters contacts like that. But define them by that attitude, and the voice and how they react will come organically. Other hooks. Visual appearance, if you can manage it, a picture of a character. Here, he looks like this.
I don't love the art in Bayern. It's there.
Well, if it's there, it's there, but at least it might trigger your memory, and it might trigger their, oh yeah, this is that chap, they can think. There's a lot of stuff on the net. There's a lot of art from science fiction and fantasy illustrations, and from illustrations of other genres as well, which you can repurpose and reuse. My pride will not allow me to use AI-developed stuff, and I don't think my morals will either.
Indeed.
Let's leave that aside, and do a little bit of research. And the ability of Google search to bring up visual images of things is quite remarkable and very useful.
If you use DuckDuckGo, you can automatically exclude AI images from that, which is jolly handy.
Okay, we will put a reference to that in the show notes, folks. And Michael may use it. I think apart from character attitude, then props and habits are very very defining. If they are always carrying this item or that item, it will act as a memory cue for you and for the players. It's all about building up detail, and it's also, unfortunately, and I'm not good at this, about keeping notes and writing the characters down in a legible form so that you can get back to them afterwards.
This is also where I call on your professional experience, though I would assume in the theatrical context you are generally looking at a particular character that you're playing for an extended period rather than something you're just constantly swapping.
Yes, this is true. Well, I consider that the job of GM is more like that of a voice artist on a show where you're expected to do lots of voices and be lots of people. It's not something I've had the opportunity. They never invited me on The Simpsons, now did they? But I would say, yeah, make each one distinct in your own mind. I think that what I'm doing mostly at the moment is using their attitude and their vocabulary and their and their reactions to the player characters they keep encountering. I think I should use more of the artwork and what have you to make each person look and feel more of an individual. It's really hard if you're holding a conversation where two or more NPCs are mixed in amongst the player characters. You have to really change focus and make it clear by your voice that you are now somebody else. I'm now not talking as the head of house. I'm now talking as the housekeeper. And she has a different attitude to him, although she's his closest ally and friend. She and he are allies, but different in their reaction to the people around the table.
I believe you were present on the occasion when our friend Peter Edge, having an argument between two NPCs, caused several people at the table to react as though a fight were about to break out.
I'm not sure I remember that, but yes, a job well done. I don't know if there's anything I can say that's going to be more helpful to...
Well, I can at least try it, and then when the next session bogs down in soap opera, everybody else can blame you.
I'm doing this on Michael's advice. Yeah, we do not accept any responsibility for any advice you may have taken. We should probably put a bit of boilerplate at the start of every episode. We are not responsible for any advice that may lead to fatalities or other.
Well, to be fair, I mean, I take this approach anyway. If I'm going to arrogate to myself supreme power, the GM is God, then I also have supreme responsibility. And I can't really use as an excuse, oh, well, the adventure said whatever. Well, I should have fixed it.
Yeah. On the other hand, I feel that sometimes I have to drop them in it. I can't not give them the hard choices. And sometimes the games turn serious faster than you can anticipate.
Mm.
Sometimes they turn serious in ways you could not have anticipated, setting up a particular... scenario or a particular campaign, which is why where I like to have safety measures, I think the X card, which is a generic safety measure, is a lot more useful than any list of things we should not be doing, because nobody thinks about the bloody endings at the start of the journey.
Yep. I know someone who is extremely squeamish about eye injury, even quite mild descriptions of it. And unless I knew that about that person, I might well put that into a game. And then if there's an X-Guard, they can say, no, I just don't want to do this. Doesn't mean I screwed up. Doesn't mean they screwed up. It just means that's not the right thing for the game right now.
Yeah. Shall we move on?
Yeah. Valued listener Shimin Beg writes, how to work with players and bring their long backstory into play so they feel all special and ting!
Ting! He wants ting!
And how to deal with players that overwrite their backstory, always the mysterious chosen one or whatever.
Well, I think that's two separate problems there,
Yes, but two sides of the same one as well.
Overwriting is sometimes a problem. I see it less nowadays, because with my regular groups, I've established that there's a certain amount that I is interesting, and we have to say there's a certain amount that I feel free to introduce to the characters, like their long lost uncle who has never been mentioned before, or their siblings who they didn't bother to outline, but who are going to naturally come up at this moment in time.
All right. I've also heard, quite possibly from you, the idea that this campaign should be the most exciting thing in the character's life to date.
Ooh, Yeah, because the character says, "Oh well, when I was in Samaria, we solved this problem in a few moments." But then,
well, yeah, he does clash somewhat with the iconic character who is implied to have done a whole bunch of this kind of thing before.
Yeah, and it's not always interesting to hear about Batman's training regime when he was just starting out. I feel that you want a couple of things in the background. And this is another bit of record keeping that I'm not good at, because I have. You should record everything that the player gives you as a possible thing you can exploit at the start, and it should be clear in your own mind. And I'm not good at that.
Using the term exploit in a very mild way.
Oh well, yeah. That I can incorporate and bring. Sometimes I exploit it in a fairly heartless and ruthless way. But let's assume that they're okay with that. What offends a player more than anybody else is when they look at you with soulful eyes and say, "But don't you remember I told you?" And you have not remembered. They told you. You have not incorporated it into your background. Now, looking around in my imagination at my current Wednesday night game, to my left, I've got Graham, whose character is a native from a privileged family, from the city where the magical institute is based. But he gave me the opportunity of a mysterious unknown enemy. And it turns out that he may not actually be a native, but was unofficially adopted by his parents when they were on a diplomatic mission. And that is causing immense complications in his life and a lot of plot, which is very good and generous of him.
Hey.
Next to him is Alan. He's also native and of a fairly privileged background, though not desperately privileged. And his father was, perhaps is, a member of Special Circumstances, or the equivalent, the people who go out and do dirty deeds for the city in other parallel realities. And he has been missing for a couple of years. Now that is another good hook. At the end of the table, I've got Martin, whose character is slightly older than the others and was studying as an archaeologist student when he was recruited to come to the magical university and learn other ways of doing things. This means that he's a character who actually wants to do research digging around in libraries and will actually go and dig around in the underground of the city. And that is absolutely wonderful service to the GM, and I appreciate it greatly. Next around we have Pum. Pum's character is a nut job who thinks he's a superhero. He goes by the name of Captain Kestrel. And wears goggles and a flight jacket all the time, and is currently qualifying for his license to be allowed to fly around the rest of the city and not just the institute. And then we have Drac, and Drac's character is from a poor Indian background in a world still dominated by the remnants of the British Empire. And I think the way Drac put it is, he doesn't know that he's oppressed and underprivileged. But coming to the city is a revelation to him, and he's going to be in line for some of the major plot developments that I have in mind for the most of the... And all of these I regard as flattery to me and service to me, and this is because I'm an egotist. So, if the player gives the GM something, or at least a couple of things, that they can work in and that they can turn to their own advantage, then I think that's going to work. On the other hand, if you're going to make it exclusively about serving your own ego, the GM is going to struggle.
Yeah, The term session zero has got a lot of currency recently, but it's occurred to me that what I have is typically two separate things that could be could happen in that, possibly simultaneously. Because the thing that's now usually taken to mean is the bit where we talk about what do we expect out of this campaign, what sort of limits are we going to have on description, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which
setting the tone,
which is good and useful. But also, since I tend to run systems which don't have extremely lightweight character generation, there is also usually a character generation session. And I'm when I've done it in GURPS, when I was playing face-to-face with the Cambridge group, we would typically do that solo at home and then bring our characters with a certain amount of discussion. But with games that are not quite as heavyweight as GURPS, I'm very much liking doing it as a group effort.
I think it's good because
then we can talk about not just interlocking backstories, but things like, well, you know, I want to do this, and then somebody else can say, yeah, but does this mean you're going to be going off on your own all the time? And is that not going to be fun?
Yeah. With characters who are serving the same ends, and I count my Magical University idea, as well as Monster Hunter teams, what have you, it's important to... All right, niche protection is important, and it's important to make the characters distinguished, not only in their background and their attitudes, but also in their practice of the thing that they do. And in this campaign, I've got three different kinds of magical system being taught to the people in the group, and two players have special extraordinary abilities to conjure up improvised magic. I should have only confined it to one, but two egos were involved. And so you need to spend the part of the session zero going, oh, are you planning to do that as well? Oh, right. And watching one of the players adapting slightly or adapting a lot, or both of them retreating from that territory in confused British embarrassment. So you've got to divide up the possibilities, and you've got to give people a chance to differentiate their characters in a fashion that is going to make them interesting and different enough to play. And people can say, here, I can do this thing that only I can do. And that's important.
As far as I'm concerned, this is pretty much the only plus point of class and level systems. If they are competently designed, and most of them are, then as long as no two characters have the same class, you won't have two characters who do the same thing, only one of them is better at it.
But I still think that perhaps my D&D memories are too far back in the past. But I do seem to recall that two fighters were worth much more than two times one. They're fighters that can work side by side and form a shield wall for all the squishy specialists cowering behind.
The other thing is, I should just say that GURPS has an explicit mechanism for this, though it's slightly disguised.
Yes.
It is the sense of duty disadvantage, subtype friends and companions.
Yeah.
This will get you 5 points, and it's basically, if another party member gets into trouble, I'm going to help them out.
Yeah.
And never mind the 5 points, which is obviously nice to have. If everybody in the party has it and your character doesn't, they're going to look at you.
I haven't actually required it here. They are because in my current Wednesday campaign, because they are all working for they're all students at the university and surviving that, and they are teammates, they are housemates, and they've naturally fallen into relying on one another. Now, I didn't rely on everybody in my college. I didn't even socialise with everybody in my college, but a college is a big place, and there were other colleges out there. And are people who are pursuing the interests that I was pursuing. And I naturally hung around with the science fiction society and the acting types. I don't think it's always necessary, but if if you anticipate them drifting apart, then perhaps that should be put in at the top. I will also say that sometimes you are under some systems, you're spending part of session zero designing the group, because the group exists as the set of stats and advantages, and you want them to feel comfortable with what the group does and what it requires of them, and the things the group can do for them.
But even without the mechanistic side, I think a certain amount of discussion of why do you hang out with these people?
Yeah,
is worth having. And an anecdote from Roger's school days. This was a mostly day but a little bit boarding school.
So
it didn't have houses in the sense that an almost all boarding school would do. So what they had were called clubs, and there were eight of them, and they were called A to H. They tried using names of famous old pupils or whatever, but nobody ever remembered them, so they just didn't bother in the end. And you got randomly assigned to one when you joined the school. And you were expected to feel some sense of loyalty and enthusiasm for it. You know, you would go out and cheer for members of your club when they were playing members of other club, which was basically every sort of team for school internal sports would happen on the club level, and then the best players of that would go to the team that played other schools. And this is where I discovered that I just lack whatever psychological element there is that causes people to fall into this kind of loyalty. Go, what do I care? I don't know these people. I've never met most of them. You've got a this colour shirt rather than that colour shirt. What the hell?
Yeah, it puzzled me at my school. They were still called houses then, and I suspect they will have atrophied away in the decades since. What I've done with the Magical University is go back to the idea of what were called Oxbridge halls, which were places of residence rather than academic societies in their own right. And basically, the university has a number of, or the institute, I should say, has a number of private houses which have been converted into dorms with a resident master and a housekeeper at each one. And because you gather around the table with them most evenings and most mornings, you know these people, and you have at least to be friendly. Otherwise, they might dump things in your bed or use up all the hot water. So you have to be friendly, and it should naturally produce a sense of comradeship.
Allowing, if you want, people to be doing completely different things in terms of their courses of study.
Yeah, and when they go help, then you will perhaps come running. What was the other thing Shemin said?
Basically, how do you work with the players to bring their backstory into play, and how to deal with players who overwrite their backstory?
You bring the story into play by using it. I think there is a problem with this, and a temptation for the GM, which is to start trying to develop the character in a way that the player doesn't want to go. I have two characters in my Monday night game, one of whom is a lawyer and the other of whom is a policeman, and they work for the magistrate. The characters, not the players.
Okay.
These are characters, not the players, though, yeah, one of them is a lawyer in real life. And the two characters have reasons for respecting the law. And, of course, as a GM, I'm going to test those reasons. I'm going to make them important things that they can either make exceptions to or can stand by no matter how damned inconvenient it is. And the policeman has seen what I'm doing, has deliberately made his character so obtuse in his understanding what the law is that he's a rock and he will never change, which I have to respect, but and he doesn't understand why some of his superiors bend things. But he will go on, and he will nonetheless go on enforcing the law as it currently exists. And the other is the lawyer, and is primarily is a conservative character, played by a conservative player, who believes very much in order and stability and as little change as possible. And that is going to be the one that I'm going to test the harder, and is going to find herself in himself, rather, the player's female, the character's male, find himself in greater difficulties, I think, than the policeman's simple faith. But I have to respect their decisions, and I should not push the characters so hard that they break.
It is a test. The test can be passed or it can be failed.
The test can be passed in different ways. The test is used to define the character, not to kill the character, but to... And to place them...
As I see it, whichever outcome there is, the character, and presumably the player, but primarily I'm looking here at the character, can look back on it and say, yeah, that was a big turning point. That was when I realised that I needed to be firm about this. Or that was when I realised that being firm about this wasn't working. Either way, they've had that moment of, I'm either different or better informed about my choice.
Yes. I think it is a temptation to the GM to be a pedagogue and try and teach something, and they shouldn't. I think they should put forward opportunities for development, but they shouldn't break the mould of the character. Unless the character wants to be remolded.
Well, I'll also say, as I usually do, that while having a chat with the player about it may remove the surprise, it does, in my experience, generally lead to much better feelings. You know, here is this test that... Are you happy for the character to be confronted with this sort of test? And we are cool that whatever you do, we're going to have an interesting outcome. Aren't we? That kind of thing.
I think what I'm going to do, what I should do, is not say that openly to a particular player, but to hint and foreshadow very much as I am at the moment, which directions the plot, the overall campaign plot, is going to go. They are going from place to place, solving cases and resolving situations. But in the background, things are burbling and bubbling. And maybe the universe is going to change in unexpected directions. But I don't know that. And I don't know exactly what that's going to be. And I have yet to reach the inspiration which will tell me how I'm going to test these people. How I'm going to make their journey interesting and not a torture. Does that answer the questions?
I think so.
All right. We hope you're satisfied and we hope you'll send us more queries. That was us for another month. We'll be back in another month. We hope you have not been April fooled too badly. And we hope that the spring is treating you kindly. And we hope that you are remembering to take your antihistamines if you're sensitive that way.
Those of us who need that sort of thing, he said, being well aware that late onset hay fever is an increasing thing, though it hasn't hit me yet.
Yeah, weakening of the immune system, old chap, seems to happen to all of us. If you want to comment upon the hay fever or any of the other matters we have touched upon in this podcast,
leave a message on the website or email podcast@tekeli.ly.
I got you to laugh. That's good. See you next time.